So for those of you that are new to Air Insight, please take some time to visit our website, airinsight.com, for the latest industry news. And for anybody who wants to become a subscriber, we have data models, insight pieces that provide the so what behind the news headlines, and lots of different analyses that will help you with your decision making. And we also provide a full range of tailored consulting services with our Air business unit. So diving into today, our very first webinar is going to be broad in scope. We're all going to get baselined exactly where we are right now. Towards the end, we're going to ask for your feedback. What would you like to see in future video briefings? We plan a mixture of broad scope and deep dive sessions. You know, we're interested in who you want to hear from, what kind of experts, what can we do to support the industry. Now, today's topic is weathering the storm. Ernie is going to be summarizing the events of the last few days and what it might mean for aerospace. Then Addison, our aviation analytics expert, will then provide a short summary of what effect this is likely to have on the airlines. Then I will be talking about some practical steps you can take to manage the human impact to give you the best human capital to see you through. So over to my colleague, Ernie.
Thanks, Fiona. I'm Ernie Harvey, president of Air Insight Group. I'd like to welcome all of you watching, especially those of you working at home and sheltering in place, as we all have been doing for what seems like an eternity. Let's look at the situation we're in today and where we may be headed. May I have the next slide, please, Fiona? Fear is everywhere today, and it's not a healthy emotion. Fear of getting sick, fear of losing income, fear of losing a loved one, fear of losing it while you're family when you're working at home. But apparently our biggest fear is running out of toilet paper. We all have fears, and assessing with where the industry is and is going will help to ease those fears, even if it's bad news. Being prepared is always better than being unprepared. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the picture for our industry today. Things aren't pretty. But things will get better and return to normal. Unfortunately, it's going to take some time to get there. Over the last year, we've had the two crisis issues for the industry. The first is the 737 MAX, which seems like nothing today compared to coronavirus. And we'll talk about the MAX in one of our future sessions. But today we'll focus on what's happening with the coronavirus and the impacts on the airlines, downstream impacts on the OEMs, the supply chain, and virtually every business associated with our industry. Air traffic forecasts have changed dramatically since December. In December, IATA was forecasting a 4.7% increase in global RPKs for 2020. Today, a 38% drop. Substantial. And Europe is taking the brunt of that, with a projection that they're going to be down 46% for next year. We really haven't seen this type of disruption since World War II, when the airlines were called into military support roles. May I have the next slide, Fiona? If we look at where we are, let's start with China, because they've been through this the longest. The area in blue shows the progression of the disease in China in terms of active cases. And it looks like China was able to somewhat flatten the curve and get ahead of the disease a little bit. The black line shows basically the number of flights, which dropped precipitously once the disease started, but has started to recover in China, primarily domestically and not too much internationally. So there is hope for recovery, and if China is a precursor of what we're going to see in other parts of the country, we're still a little bit behind the curve. If I could have the next slide. This slide shows where we are in China today in terms of domestic and international flying. The black line shows the domestic flights, which peaked out at a very low level, which dropped to a very low level, and have since been rising and stabilizing at a little over 60% of what they were at the beginning. international flying is still dropped way off in China, as they've closed their borders to foreigners, except for a few flights. I think one flight per country per week to keep the virus from spreading again. So the international flights are still quite down in China, and we expect the recovery as other nations in the world recover and things get restored on a one by one basis. If we're indeed a couple of months behind China, as we suspect, we're looking at early May for the beginning to start to get back to normal for travel and to end the lockdown. That means 5 to 7 more weeks of us being cooped up and working from home with our families, and it's hard to believe it's been less than 2 weeks so far. It feels like a lot more. We are social beings, and we need interpersonal contact, and if you're like me, restaurants, theaters, and open golf courses. Can end soon enough, and we'll try to hopefully move that forward if we're successful in social distancing. South Korea, on the next chart, there was initial indications of a stabilizing market. They've come up to the peak, and new cases are starting to fall. They're not where China is at the tail end of the curve, but flights in South Korea have stabilized, albeit at a low level. It doesn't appear that they're going to drop below that and may start to rise again soon. If we look at Europe, it's hit quite hard, and this is a graph for Italy. Virtually come to a grinding halt, down to about 5% of previous levels. The curve is still going up, and this is March 22nd, so we're probably somewhere up here. And we're hoping that we've reached a peak in Italy, but it's not certain yet with the last couple of days. Today and tomorrow will tell whether the trend is downward or not in terms of new cases, and overall cases begin to drop. Here in Italy as well, the north part of Italy is showing a peak. The southern part of Italy is still growing, and region by region, things may be a bit different. Right now, the medical community in Italy remains overwhelmed, and it's still a problematic situation. If we look at Spain, we've got a similar situation. Flights there are down to we're down to about 11%, and they're still going down this week as the virus rises again in Spain. May I have the next slide? The U.S. is now experiencing a major upturn in several hotspots. Overall, we're not growing at the exponential level, except in New York, New Orleans, Detroit, and a few hotspots where our social distancing apparently hasn't worked well. Hopefully we can remain at home and limit the growth, particularly since I'm in the Detroit area and next to one of the hotspots. But it appears that we'll have pockets of disaster in the U.S., starting with New York. If you were watching the arrival of the ship yesterday, there were crowds that were certainly not social distancing near, and the behavior seems strange, that people just don't believe how serious this crisis has been for a lot of people. Our domestic flights are still operating at a very reduced level. Flight cancellations are growing. Carriers are reducing their schedules once more in the April schedule, which comes out this week. Domestic load factors are down substantially, and Edison has some data. Show we're down in the 7 to 8% of normal range operations. International flights have taken the largest hit, flight cancellations on a global scale, but we have seen some movement of passenger aircraft converted to cargo use. We saw Delta A350, formerly flying the Amsterdam route out of Detroit, that's now flying a cargo route with the seats covered, cargo in the seats and cargo in the belly. From the Detroit hub. What everyone wants to know is, how long is this thing going to last? You know, we're not doctors, but if China is a prologue for the others, we've got a couple of months left. But to truly beat the disease, it looks like getting to the tail of the curve may take us 6 months. And that's when we'll finally curb the impact. But the other hopeful sign is we're now in spring, when influenza outbreaks typically die out due to higher temperatures and improved immune systems from additional sunlight. Surprisingly, vitamin D is a very good fighter of viri. And so be sure to get outside for a couple of days. Being cooped up inside is not a good thing. A little bit of sunshine on your face and whatever can be exposed, depending on the outside temperature, will help in terms of immunity. Nobody knows the real length and depth of the potential crisis as yet, but if we listen to the experts, it's going to stand a little bit longer than any of us want. At least through April, things will be canceled, so we've got another month of sitting at home at a minimum, and probably 2 months before this thing really gets going. There was a survey of business leaders just recently that I saw that indicates that most people don't expect a full resumption until September. But we do. What we do know is that once an industry like ours comes to a dead stop, which it pretty much has, it typically takes 12 to 18 months to return to full production once it resumes, particularly for long lead time items produced in hard hit areas. Next slide, please. The government bailout for the U.S. Domestic airlines appears adequate to keep them going until fall and maintaining employment, which is great in the U.S. Internationally, we're seeing some bankruptcies. We've seen a nationalization of Alitalia, and the outlook is much less certain. In Europe, some of the low-cost carriers appear in much better shape than some of the old traditional full-service carriers to maintain their positive cash flow. EasyJet, Ryanair, and Wizz Air all have pretty decent cash positions right now, and they also own a fair number of percentage of their fleet, so that sale and leasebacks are possible to really to provide extra cash to weather the storm. Some of the national carriers don't have that luxury, and maybe in more difficulty. What's going to happen from that is obviously some deferred and canceled orders. The leasing companies are the first line of defense, and they'll be making some of the decisions as to who's likely to survive or not by basically pulling airplanes for those with weak financial positions and probably extending credit a little bit to those who are in a little bit better shape. So watch what the leasing companies do, and you'll know which airlines are likely to fail and not fail. We're expecting a recovery to be somewhere between a V and a U-shaped recovery, and what I'll call as a checkmark recovery. A V-shaped recovery is a quick return back to normal. I don't see a quick return here coming. A U-shaped recovery has us at the bottom for a long period of time, and I don't think we'll be at the bottom forever. And improvements will begin very shortly once the tail of the disease wanes. But that recovery period may be the longer checkmark shape. So we'll be coming up at an angle. One of the problems is getting back to work is going to be a logistical nightmare because we've got different timeframes for supplier shutdowns. China's just starting to come back, so we may see some raw materials that we've being replenished fairly shortly from China that we haven't seen in a while. But component manufacturers worldwide are experiencing local conditions that are quite different, and they're in different positions depending on where you are. Italy's been particularly hard hit and has some pretty key suppliers. The former Alenia operation from Leonardo builds a whole fuselage section for the 787. What happens when inventory runs out if Italy is hard hit, particularly if the southern part of Italy starts to ramp up with the disease? Avio makes blades for the Leap and the gearbox for the GTF. A prolonged outage at Avio, which is a real possibility, could result in aircraft with concrete blocks hanging off their wings in Toulouse and in Seattle. The disruption is one of the things that adds to the uncertainty because we don't know when individual suppliers are going to be able to come back and how quickly they and their supply chains could rebound. OEMs need to carefully re-examine the supply chain at this point, and suppliers need to be as flexible as possible because these disruptions can lead to some new opportunities. Now more than ever, communication between OEMs and suppliers remains very critical. And we're not seeing enough communication publicly. Hopefully it's happening privately. But both parties are basically facing unknowns. And the degree that we can work together to solve those unknowns will help the situation in recovery. Shortages in those areas, if we could go back, Fiona. Thank you. Shortages can provide a problem, even for the smallest part. Airlines have nearly a million parts, but any one missing part can ground an aircraft. So we're shooting at a moving target, and planning really means we've got to look at several scenarios to prepare for what could be differing eventualities. In our future sessions, we'll highlight findings from our latest Air Insight research forecast, which we think will be released to our clients later today. I know Michelle Merlizzo is busy working on those in Seattle. Next week, we hope to have some highlights of where our latest forecasts are going. 18 months until we return to full production is certainly not good news. It takes time for major economic displacement and fears to abate, and traffic levels are not likely to spring back instantly. Pick up demand from folks like us stuck in their houses who want to go places? Certainly. The question is whether everyone will be able to afford it, given the economic impacts on a lot of workers, particularly workers in our industry. We've got more questions than answers today, but the picture is beginning to come together and indicates our industry's turmoil will, unfortunately, last into 2021 and potentially beyond for some players. None of us want to hear bad news. It's better to plan for the worst. 100% hope for the best. I'd like to turn it over to Addison Sharnland, who will discuss some of the types of aircraft likely to gain favor once the industry recovers, and show you some of our decision analytic models and how they can impact the situation. Addison, over to you.
Before Addison gets started, I just want to remind people, if you have questions for Ernie, please enter them in the chat screen, and we'll go back to those at the end. So I've stopped screen sharing. So now, Addison, over to you.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning from where I am. Good day to you wherever you may be. Thank you for joining us. I'd like to echo Ernie and Fiona's welcome. Thank you for sharing some time with us today. First chart I want to show you in the model here is a big picture. This is U.S. domestic traffic from 1995 through the end of 2019. In that period, we've had the 2008 financial meltdown, we've had SARS, we've had the last flu epidemic. As you can see, there are bumps in the road, but the industry keeps moving up to the top-hand right corner. In the chart, the upper chart, you'll see we have a bit of a forecast. Five-year forecast with ignoring the last 2 years, and you can see the line is pretty stable. Now, this current pandemic is going to cause a sharp change from what would be the historic forecast here. But 7 years from now, 5 years from now, we should be back at the long-term trend. In this particular model, for example, we can show you an airline one at a time, but I'm not going to dwell on that today. The next chart is looking at the latest TSA information, which we got this morning. The dark blue line at the top is 2019. The lighter blue line is 2020 over here, as you can see. And this is the percentage. As of yesterday, we were at 7% of last year's screening by the TSA in the US. So that gives you a sense of how the market has shrunk. However, look at the bottom here. We've had 8%, 8%, 8%, 7%. There seems to be a flattening out of the curve. That is something we all want to watch very carefully. Let's take a look at the world picture. This is from Flight Radar. They also update this thing every day. Go on their website and see it. What do we see here? We see a little bump. One swallow doesn't make a summer. We know that. But this is an area also to look for recoveries. Those flights that spiked there might be freighters, could be, but we want to see that turn to get a better sense of which way the momentum is moving, because in the end, that's what we have to look for. Now, on my next slide, I want to show you the US traffic, also from 1995 to 2019, but here from an OEM standpoint. In this very colorful chart, each one of these colors is a year. And here's 2019, 2018, 2017, and in each block, you can see the model of CS, the 737-800, 129 million passengers, 737-700, 122 million passengers, and so on. Again, I don't want to get stuck in the weeds. This chart here on the bottom left shows you the dark blue is the percentage of traffic flying on what we call MOM, middle of the market airplanes. About 180 to 240 seats, so that would be 737-900s, the MAX-9s when they fly, 321s, 757s. And if we still had 767-200s, for example. And this chart shows the traffic numbers flying on Boeing or Airbus in the US over the period. Now, here's something interesting. You can see the 757 was the king of the hill here, and then as they started to retire, they disappeared. But this growth, which I'm trying to show without the blockage, but basically from 2015 onwards down here, that came from the 321 moving into the market very strongly. Again, we can look at individual airlines for those of you who are interested later on. Now, here, another look at the OEMs. Let's start with the top one, Airbus. This is the traffic flow. This is the percentage breakdown. And what you see is that the 320 family is very strong, but down here in the bottom right-hand corner, very small red bar, is the A220, which came on stream last year. We think that's going to have quite an influence. If we look at the flow of traffic, you can see again the impact that the 321 has. It's very strong. And at the bottom here, the Neo has started to move in. When we look at Boeing, though, 86% of the traffic is 737 oriented. You can see how the 757 has shrunk. And if we look at this, the breakdown by family type, you can see here where we are with all the Boeings retiring and going out of service, and how the company is now still quite dependent on the traffic on the no longer built 757. And the 737 is pretty much what they have to move traffic these days. So, in summary, it seems to us that the recovery from various people we've been speaking to, they talk to us between 24 months, 48 months, as long as 48 months. That's number one. Number two, the market is going to recover. It's going to be painful. There's going to be disruptions, but it will recover at some stage. None of us know with any certainty. In terms of fleet, it seems to us that going forward, when you come out of this, people are telling us the first airplanes they want to load up are regional jets, turboprops, anything under 100 seats, because you can sell that capacity. It's a low risk solution. You can sell those 50 seats or 80 seats in an RJ, a regional jet. Next up would be the E190s and the A220s, because those are like 100 seats. Easy to sell that capacity. By the way, anecdotally, Delta has not parked one A220. That's a very interesting little tidbit for you to think about. In terms of the larger single aisles, it seems to us that the best placed airplane will be the 737-900 and the A321. The 321, particularly because it can do domestic US traffic, it can do transcon traffic, and it now has in the Neo version and the LR version, has the ability, and even the XLR, will have the ability to do transoceanic traffic. Again, a limited capacity, easy to sell. Clearly, what we have to consider here is for the airline industry, low risk solutions as they come out of this. And we will talk about wide bodies in a future event. Thank you. Back to you, Fiona.
Thank you, Addison. Could you stop sharing your screen? Thank you. So now we're moving to the human impacts. And as we've discussed multiple times today, there is an unprecedented amount of fear right now. But it's not just the news that's causing this. It actually goes much deeper. Hormones are literally flooding the brain and the nervous system right now. And the brain does not register pandemics. Very, very few people have been through that before. So the brain doesn't actually know whether to pick fight, flight, or freeze right now. So if you're seeing some strange behaviors amongst your colleagues and family members, it's no surprise. Life is weird. People feel uncomfortable, and that is leading to anxiety. What does that mean for the workplace? Well, Yerk and Dodson's inverted U theory would suggest that most people right now are likely in the high stress and anxiety stage. So performance is likely to be affected. One thing that I would like to add is that this will not be consistent for all employees. It will differ dependent on personality type. And your more extroverted employees are likely to cope better than your introverted employees. So make sure you're taking care of everyone. You will also likely see gender differences in the way people are responding right now. And when I talk about gender differences, I'm actually talking about a bell curve. We all sit on different parts, and about 20% of the population is actually hardwired the opposite way. But you will be seeing differences in the way men and women are responding in general because of the way they respond to the stress hormone cortisol. For men, cortisol depletes their testosterone levels, which leads to anxiety and irritability. For women, cortisol actually increases their testosterone levels, which impacts their levels of oxytocin. And that is their hormone that is responsible for trust and harmony. So men's way typically of coping with this is to go off and take on lone wolf tasks and be quiet about it. That helps them to replenish their testosterone. Whereas women are far more likely to actually want to talk it out, because actually nurturing those relationships, it actually replenishes oxytocin. So, you know, considering the gender makeup of aerospace, you know, if you, make sure that you're considering how, you know, the men and women in your team communicate differently. You know, it's likely that your female employees are going to want to talk about this. It's completely normal. So, you know, please engage. It actually helps to reduce stress levels. So how can you help your employees right now? So I want you to remember the three C's. So first of all, it's care. So people are looking for care from other people right now. They're looking for compassion. You know, take an interest. How is this impacting people? What's going on in their families? You know, actually show that you appreciate that this is much bigger than just your workplace, and engage them in their communication style. In addition, you know, connection is essential. So make sure you've got regular check-ins with your employees, you know, ideally at a regular time each day, because certainty and stability actually makes a huge difference. Clear and transparent communication, that helps to, you know, it helps people to know that they're connected to the messages that are coming from the top. You want to be as transparent as possible right now. And then giving people the chance to be creative. They're now facing novel problems that they've never faced before. You know, give them a chance to actually come up with creative ideas. You know, avoid the conflicting requests, remove the red tape, you know, organizational politics, other hassles. You know, push those away to create an environment where people can bring their solutions to you. And remember that this is a challenge for your customers and suppliers too. They are going through the exact same thing. The recovery is not going to be a straight line. So actually some collaboration and some compassion with your customers and suppliers right now, that is going to give you some capital with them later on. Now, the last thing I want to touch on today is the human side of the recovery. I think the one thing that this whole experience has taught us is, you know, that humans are going to be the key to getting us out of this. And right now, we know that aerospace is struggling. You know, IAM is reporting that there's over 500,000 aerospace production jobs alone at risk right now. We've seen big layoffs with GE and Spirit. And now a lot of the smaller manufacturers are being hit hard too, some with furloughs and some with more permanent layoffs. If you are in the position to be more selective about how you manage this, then consider that the skills you're going to need come the fall are going to be very different to the skills that you need today. You know, today you need people that can be decisive, can judge the current situation and take action. But coming out of this, you know, you're going to need your customer facing people. You're going to need people that can build teams and create shared solutions. So you're really looking for those team members that have got the problem solving, tenacity, compassion, and resilience. Those are going to be really, really important as we dig our way out of this. So that is the end of our presentation for today. I now want to jump to questions. And our first question is from Dean Cameron. His question is, we are seeing a shift of suppliers to medical. You know, our suppliers, they need to stop surviving and start thriving, so they're going to look to support other industries. Is this going to lead to an even greater shortage? Have any studies taken place yet on this? So I'd put that question to Ernie and Addison.
Thanks, Fiona. I don't think we've seen any specific studies on that, because the recent shifts from aerospace to medical production have come in the last couple of weeks. So we haven't studied that in any sort of detail as yet. But it's a topic that we need to look at, because there's a transition to the medical equipment that takes some time. And then once the need is solved, there's a transition back to aerospace production. And how long that transition takes will depend on the types of products that we have. Clearly, we want to maintain workforce as one of the key things, and maintain those skilled players that we have in the industry. And it's a good thing that we have the flexibility to change and produce medical equipment to survive. But we haven't yet seen enough information about how many suppliers are participating and who's doing what as yet to come to a point.
We do know, for example, GE workers in one of the aerospace plants wanted to walk off the job because they want to be building respirators. So that's a labor-led interesting behavior. Pratt & Whitney's boss was speaking at the White House yesterday about using additive manufacturing to start making medical parts, medical, I think it was shields, face shields is one of the things that he was talking about. I know that McLaren, the Formula One team, has come up with a way to build, in a matter of days, mind you, they came up with a way to build a respirator. Medtronic has put their one of their patented products in the open for anybody to build the technology. And by the way, they're going to put the software code online so anyone can build it. So like Ernie said, it's very early days. I don't think we have a lot of anecdotal things. I don't know that there's any firm trend, but I think that what we are seeing, that people are not waiting for government, not waiting for some kind of big leader here to give us a path forward. Down to the workforce in a GE factory, people are stepping up and saying, we don't have to wait. We can actually move into this, and we've got high tech skills. We've got the 3D additive manufacturing. Once they have the plans of what they need to build, they can do that. So I think in answer to the questioner, it's too soon to tell, but anecdotally, there are interesting things happening, and it's something to worthwhile watching.
Thank you, Addison and Ernie. So our next question is from Jim Bowden. What are your thoughts on consolidation in the North American airline industry sector? Who would be the likely targets? JetBlue, Frontier? And that question would be for Addison.
Well, you know, if we looked at the model again, we could see what happened to people like Delta when they took Northwest, American, US Airways, United, Continental. They became fortress airlines. I think it's quite possible that we're going to see this happen again. Spirit, for example, announced yesterday that they were going to change their share structure so that they could not be taken over. With, you know, nobody could take 10% in the company without them executing some sort of defense. I think it's clear that this is quite a possible outcome. For example, before we even had the crisis, there was talk about, if you're a Southwest and you cannot get your max fleet, but you have to keep growing and you need capacity, why don't you buy something? You can't buy a max. So why don't you just buy an airline like maybe JetBlue? Who knows? I think it's early days. The airline industry right now probably could benefit from consolidation from an airline operation standpoint. We consumers would hate that. But on the other hand, they don't have the money. And I don't think Wall Street will fund it, something like this so easily now. All the airlines have maxed out on their debt. So yes, it's a good idea, but I don't know how the wind blows right now to make that happen.
Plus, with the government bailout, Addison, I think the airlines will have the money they need to survive at least through the end of September without any without losing any employees and covering their fixed costs. So there's no urgency behind that right now.
Thank you. That was a great question. And these are really good questions to help us come up with future sessions. So our next question is from Patrick Bowdis. So beyond the A320 737 splits, have we looked at aircraft categories SA, WB, RJ from previous crises? Sorry, single aisle, wide body, regional jet. From previous crises, we saw regional jets being impacted later and recovering earlier than any other type. What's your take on this?
Patrick, it's a great question. It's obviously something that has been quite a large part of my conversations with people that are preparing for this session today. Several people have pointed out that the regional jets were the last to go to get parked last time there was a shock like this, and they're first to come back. And I think that, as I mentioned to you earlier on, they are the low-risk option for airlines to bring back service. So I think that we can expect that as the airlines come back on stream again, the focus is going to be from the bottom up, and that we can expect things like RJs, even turboprops, to find work first because it's easy to sell that capacity.
And a final question in the chat is from Tim Robinson. Do you expect all of the parked aircraft to return to service? And if you do see a glut of airlines suddenly back in service with low oil prices, what does that mean for Airbus and Boeing sales and production rates?
Who's that for?
Well, I'll try, Addison, and starting with that one. I expect to see a lot of the parked aircraft back in service, not necessarily 100%, but as the industry returns to normal, we'll have differences by type. Certainly, the wide body demand appears that it'll be weak in the near term with. No international flying, and I think that will come back slowly. So wide bodies may be distressed for a while, and some of the older wide bodies may not come back if they have orders for replacement aircraft and they need to take new A350s or 737s or even 777X when that arrives. So we'll see a change there. In terms of the narrow bodies, we've had some carriers already extending the life on older NGs to get through the MAX crisis. Now with those sitting on the ground, will they be needed once we get traffic back? Because it's likely that the MAX will be back in production, and it's also likely that a number of those aircraft that are sitting on the ground that have been completed but not yet delivered will be available for delivery. So that probably eliminates the needs for some of the older NGs that are in service that were brought back. The question is, economically, are those airplanes nearing an overhaul and ready for retirement? Or do we just spend a lot of money in refurbishing those aircraft to get a few more years' life out of them? One thing airlines hate to do is give back an airplane with some time left. And you'd rather run that airplane out and defer the delivery of a new aircraft. So I think from a timing standpoint, the last job in the world I'd like to have right now is managing the skyline at Boeing or Airbus, because you've got changes coming at you in every direction and a real uncertainty as to who's going to be able to take delivery of aircraft right now.
Tim, my thought on this is, I think that, like Ernie pointed out, some of the airplanes are not going to come back. I don't know that 767s come back. Some of the old 330s might not come back. Qantas apparently has flown their last 747 flight for now, but the airplanes are not going to the desert. They're going to be temporarily parked. Of course, we don't understand really the implications of temporarily parked. Barclays put out an interesting note where they said they think Airbus comes out of the pandemic better off than Boeing, because they have the kinds of airplanes people want, which is going to be, for example, the 220 and the 321, because they are so flexible, they have long range, and they're very capable in their space. So in terms of orders, I think that what we might see is 320 Neos converted to 321s with later delivery, to buy the airline's time. The leasing companies, I don't know how they're going to handle this. There's going to be probably a big shakeout. We had the question about airline consolidation. We might even see some more consolidation amongst the lessors. It's so early to tell what the airlines are going to do. For example, is the plane owned or not owned? What are their choices? And it might go in the end on a sort of frame by frame basis. That's my thoughts.
Okay, and we've had another new question come in from Jim. When will international travel recover? Trans-Pacific, transatlantic? Do you think travel patterns will change in the interim? Do we expect to see a move from air to rail or auto?
I don't expect much international traffic recovery until the fourth quarter of this year at best. We've seen cancellations of major events, so none of us will be going to Farnborough this year, and that in itself is bringing a couple of 100,000 people to an event. So traffic will be impacted by the deferral of activities through July and August. We've seen the first conference I've seen that's still on is probably late September, early October. Those are at risk of being canceled. We've seen the Olympics be canceled. We've seen or postponed. Almost everything is deferred back. And it looks like it won't be until 2021 where we see international traffic really beginning to recover. The question is, will it recover back to the same level that it has been? And I think the answer is probably no initially. Some pent-up demand for face-to-face meetings with people. We may be entering a new era where technology and technologies like the one we're using today begin to substitute for in-person meetings in many situations. I think we're going to see a change from what we have in the past in terms of travel demand and the need for face-to-face meetings. And that may be the fundamental change that comes out of this, is a reliance on information technology more than we have in the past.
A thought occurs to me. I think business travel will come back first, because business travel is so relationship driven, particularly in a time of service industry. But it cannot come back. For example, China is allowing domestic travel to occur, but not allowing international travel to come in. So the recovery is going to depend on how each country opens its borders and allows traffic to come back. Again, we're on uncharted waters here. No one's been down a road. There's no playbook that you can turn to and say, well, this is what should happen. It's very difficult to say, and I think that it's going to be, like Ernie spoke about the check mark, the upstroke might have some bumps in it as it goes up. It's very difficult to offer any kind of confidence in when things are going to happen or how they're going to happen.
The bump up on production rates is going to be very slow. And we're certainly not going to see the levels that we've had over the last couple of years for narrow body production, nor are we going to see the levels that we've had for wide body production. Boeing cut back on the 787 already. I don't think we're going to see the MAX resume at anywhere near the capacity that that they had previously. And even the A320 family line isn't going to increase in the near future, as it's going to be tough for airlines to take any new deliveries in the near term. So I think we're going to see a 2020 is going to be our washout year, and a rebuild starting in 2021. It's going to be much lower than we ever anticipated. And I think the supply-demand balance, which was in favor of demand, moved toward a more balanced position of supply and demand, and reduce the production levels that we've seen over the last couple of years. Full production may not resume till 2023, till we get to those rate 6 levels that people have been talking about.
Thank you. Now, would anybody like to ask a question verbally? And remember to come off mute if you do have a question you'd like to ask verbally. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us today. If you have any requests for future content, the kind of people you want to see present, or you'd like to have an extended session with a member of our team from today, please get in touch. My email address is there, fmckay-ready@airinsight.com, or you can do info@airinsight.com. We'll watch today's call. We'll look how we can improve in future sessions. Ernie has a microphone on order, so you'll be able to hear his wisdom more clearly. And we appreciate you staying on. And we'll make sure that our future sessions are scheduled for a full hour with presentations for 30 minutes and us being available for questions for a further 30 minutes. So thank you, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm going to stay on with Ernie and Addison.